morning, everybody. It's Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. As all of us know, yesterday was the 15th anniversary of the attack on 9/11, and as most people of a certain age would say, we all know where we were on that moment when it happened. And in 15 years, a great deal has changed in this culture, in this society, in this world, as a result, in part, of those attacks on 9/11. We've seen a world where there has been an increased security here nationally, the growth of a national security industry that is beyond anything that was ever imagined before, from the advanced Orion systems in the sky, watching everything that's going on, to building under Bush and Obama, this national security presence. We also have seen a world at war for 15 years without end. And it has changed the nature of American society, I think world society as a whole. We're going to wrestle with what we think all this has meant in the last 15 years and where it's taking us now, and what, even this election, as you look at people running for office, is anybody saying anything new and different about what is happening here as a result of 9/11 15 years later? We are joined by Sam Faddis, who's a retired CIA operations officer and author. Phyllis Dennis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, as well as being a noted author, as is Dr. Tabet Abdullah, Associate Professor in Middle East History at York University in Toronto. And folks, welcome back. Good to have you back with us again as a group.
Thank you.
Be with you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. Send an email to talk@steinershow.org. But do call us at 410-319-8888. So, you know, when we think about 15 years ago, and I remember Phyllis and you've been on the show for so many decades now, and leading up to the war in Iraq, you were there in all those debates and discussions that we were having, as where we met Tabet Abdullah and Sam Faddis. And the question really is, you know, in a broader sense, how this has changed the nature and the fabric of our politics, our way of life, how we go about our world. I mean, and I think the folks who were not around before 9/11, who are of a younger age, kind of don't even get a sense of how different it is today. I mean, how would you describe that, Phyllis?
Well, I think it's actually appropriate, Mark, that we're having this discussion not on September 11th, but on September 12th. Because in my view, it was not September 11th and those horrific attacks that changed our world and that threatened our existence, as we were told. It was what happened on September 12th, which was the day that President Bush told the world that his response to this horrific crime against humanity would be to go to war, that he would lead the world to war. And it's that war that has transformed the world, our own part of the world, as well as the rest of the world. And I would argue, put people, us included, but mainly people in other parts of the world, at much greater risk. So I think that, you know, the question of how we defined the what those attacks meant and what that threat was and was not really shaped what came later. You know, I was thinking yesterday there was a radio special that had to do with the authorization for the use of military force that was passed about 72 hours or so after the attacks, where there was no opposition in the Senate, and only one brave opponent, Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California, in the Congress, who voted no. As a result, she, of course, had to have police protection for 6 months because of death threats. But it turned out she was right. She was right that it was an overbroad gift to a president that would then use it to justify wars far beyond the actual language of those 60 words in the authorization, one which President Obama has used as well. He said, we would like another authorization, but if we don't have it, that's okay, because we think we can still rely on the old one that said very specifically that it was to be used against those who had carried out the attacks of 9/11 and those who harbored them. So, you know, what we face now is a world of war that is expanding, not contracting. We see military victory on occasion against ISIS in terms of shrinking their territorial control. If you look at it by itself, that's a good thing. But the reality is that terrorism is on the rise for all of the same reasons that it was on the rise 20 years ago, because those reasons have not been dealt with. What we've seen has been an attempt to go to war against terrorism. We've been at war with terrorism for 15 years now, and terrorism is doing just fine. It's the people and the cities and the countries where the U.S. has dropped its bombs of the so-called war on terror that are not doing so well. And that's what I think is the huge contradiction that we face. We talk about a war on terror as if terror was a finite object that you could bomb out of existence, instead of something that people turn to when they are desperate, desperate out of a combination of poverty and dispossession and disenfranchisement and despair and a whole host of reasons that make people turn to terrorism. And the notion that we can somehow bomb it out of existence simply, to me, speaks to the ignorance of those who would claim that that's how you can deal with terrorism and expect to succeed.
Sam, reflecting on the same thing before we turn to Talbot, I mean, just how you think this has changed us politically on this planet and in this country.
Well, I think it's clearly come to dominate our politics, and I think, I mean, inevitably, we are in a worldwide conflict. There is a very, very real threat. We can't ignore it. I think, unfortunately, we have, over the course of 15 years, taken any number of actions that have been counterproductive or at best not helpful at all, including generating giant new bureaucracies and squandering a lot of money and undertaking a lot of very dubious nation-building exercises. So I guess I would say 15 years later, we're still trying to figure out how to get this right.
Talbot, and I refresh our memories. I don't recall exactly when this happened where you were.
I had just come to Canada, and then very briefly, that's when it happened, when I was in Canada. But then very soon afterward, I went to Syria, and I was living in Syria when you and I first met on the phone.
Correct.
On the show.
Correct. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, but to me, the way that 9/11 has changed the world is that it's masked over the real causes for crises, the dislocations that people feel, basis of violence. It's completely masked them over. So now, whenever we discuss the Middle East or any other place in the world, it's always in terms of with some sort of a reference to 9/11 and terrorism. Whereas to me, I really think that the underlying causes are primarily economic, and the collapse of the Soviet Union. These are the two things that have created a sense of imbalance in the world, with the end of the bipolar world, the end of some sort of a vision for a replacement to the capitalist system of economics. Whether good or not, there was at least some sort of a vision that people debated over and discussed and so forth. That has now all gone, and what's left is a very raw sense of exploitation in the world, which is being the outrage against that is being expressed in increasingly fascistic and very violent terms. 9/11 has masked over all of this discussion. It's made it simply a question of these bad, crazy guys out there who are committing suicide operations, and we need to get them. I do believe we need to do something, of course, about these very violent individuals. But the underlying causes have completely disappeared from any discussions, and that's the biggest tragedy of 9/11.
And so you've also said some really interesting things here, and folks, do join us at 410-319-8888. This is it has affected our body politic. It's a major part of this presidential election and every election that takes place, even some state and local elections it affects, and clearly has affected elections around the world and politics around the world. And, I was thinking about, I watched this piece that caused a huge stir and discussion, apparently, among former intelligence officers in the CIA. There's a woman named Amaryllis Fox who had a video put out. She said she was CIA operations officer, as you were, Sam. But in that, and I've seen many former CIA people come back and attack what she had said in that piece. But one of the things she said was, in interrogations of people who had been captured or surrendered, who had worked for Al-Qaeda or other groups, they said, we all watch movies too, and we watch things like Star Wars, and in Star Wars you all cheer for Luke Skywalker and the rebels. And he said, we on the ground here see ourselves as Luke Skywalker and you as the Empire. Which I thought was a really interesting kind of piece. I mean, and I think that things are in some ways turned on their heads a little bit. And the complexity of what motivates people to do what they do, whether they're in Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or young Arab students and intellectuals and workers demonstrating throughout the Arab world trying to find democracy. This is a complex thing. And I think one of the things that Taba just said, we try to make this thing much too simplistic.
That's certainly true. One of the things I think that we do is to try to reduce everything to how does it have something to do with us? It's all about us. It's all about why do they hate us? Why do they, et cetera, about us? When, if you really look at it, what it has more to do with is people's response to what we're doing to them, not people don't hate us because of our freedoms. They, to the degree that hate is even a relevant term, and I'm not really sure it's the right one, but whatever. If people hate us, hate the United States, it's because of what the United States does supporting dictators that destroy their lives. It's not about what we do here at home. And I think that sense of what Tabat was just saying about the root causes being left out is really a crucial factor here. We leave out the question of even searching for root causes, partly because it's become an unacceptable part of the discourse. I can remember right after 9/11, in articles and speeches, when you said the words root causes, it was a trigger. It was an immediate trigger to a certain set of, far too big a set of people saying, oh, you're a defender of terrorists. You're apologizing for terrorism. You're accepting it as legitimate. As opposed to saying, wait a minute, if we're serious about stopping this, and we should be, we have to get serious about why it happens. And that means understanding the real motivations. Looking at history. History is kind of out of the picture now. In the Middle East region, it's only one region of the world, but it's one region that has seen a huge level of failure over recent decades in the efforts to struggle for people's rights as citizens and more. There was the failure of Arab socialism. There was a failure of Arab nationalism, a failure of pan-Arabism, a failure of Arab neoliberalism. All of those systems failed to deliver the rights that people were searching for. And as situations in so many countries deteriorated and became more militarized and more faced with extremism, people do what everybody does faced with that. They retreat into smaller and smaller identities, turning to family and clan and religion as opposed to bigger national identities. And that's part of what we're seeing. It's part of why in Iraq, say, there's a significant component, not everybody obviously, but a significant component of Iraqi Sunnis who see ISIS not as a great thing, but as a lesser evil to this sectarian, Shia-dominated, U.S.-backed and U.S.-armed government that has been directly oppressing the Sunni community for a long time. Now, if there had been pressure on that government to stop the kind of repression based on sectarianism that has been going on for so long, support for ISIS would have been way less, and they would have been way weaker. They wouldn't have been able to do what they were able to do in Syria, in Iraq, because they wouldn't have had the support that made that possible. So if we don't look at history, including our own role in that history, our own role in creating and arming and paying off sectarian governments across the region, certainly not only in Iraq, but what we've done in Saudi Arabia, et cetera. You know, without that, these crisis situations would not have emerged in the way that they did.
Is it fair? There are some really important things to look back on for a moment here. I think that, is it fair to lay part of the blame of what we face in the world today to the launching of the war in Iraq?
Absolutely.
Sam Faddis.
Well, I think it is certainly fair to say that if we had not launched the war in Iraq and undertaken specific actions that we did, that we would not be at this precise moment facing the precise issues that we're facing. Would that mean that we would not be facing a different reality that would be just as daunting? I don't think so. And I'm no defender of many decisions made by either the Bush administration or, quite frankly, the Obama administration in Iraq. But the fundamental issues in Iraq, which are, in fact, generating fuel for ISIS, predate the United States being involved there by about 1,500 years. I mean, the fact of the matter is the nation really doesn't exist as a country. And once that lid was taken off, the place boiled over and split apart. That certainly does not suggest that it was a paradise before, or the solution to that was just to leave Iraq under the control of a brutal dictator who would gas people by the thousands as if that is preferable. So would we be in the same place? Certainly not. We'd be in a different place. I'm not sure it would be better.
Can I take a crack at that?
Please go ahead, Talbot.
There's a couple of things that are very important to be clear about. In the mid-1960s, Egypt's per capita GDP was four times bigger than that of China. Today, the situation is exactly the reverse. The region today, only 4% of the world's global imports go to the Middle East. It's almost completely detached from the world economy. The region is also completely detached from itself. It's unintegrated. Only 16% of the exports of the region go inside the region itself. Anything that the region exports really go outside. There's almost one-third of the youth in the region as a whole is completely unemployed. And if we look at mass unemployment, then the percentage is much, much higher. There was a report that was done a couple of years ago that noted that on average, a government worker in Kuwait does only 18 minutes of productive labor a day. These are conditions, and plus, of course, on top of all that, the type of repression and dictatorship that Saddam Hussein or Hafez al-Assad, or indeed the Saudi regime, you know, its use of Wahhabism, the type of repression is unimaginable to many people. I mean, many people think there's an exaggeration over this, but I lived under Saddam Hussein, and I lived in Syria, and it is so suffocating that I think much of the dislocations that we see today would have happened regardless. But the American invasion of Iraq has intensified anti-Western feelings. It has placed the United States in a very clear corner in the minds of people that the United States is behind what the collapse, that the United States has a very definitive plan that has been drawn up many decades ago for completely destroying the Arab world and humiliating all Muslims. This is what the American invasion has intensified in people's minds. But in terms of the underlying causes, No, this I think what we're seeing today was a storm that was coming long before.
Can I just add one quick thing?
Well, please.
The factor that rarely gets included here, I mean, I think that the U.S. war in Iraq was a huge factor. It certainly was what led to the creation of ISIS, but I think it was a huge factor in the broader regional destabilization, et cetera. But I think the issue of climate that we rarely sort of link to the question of crises in the Middle East that have to do with water, has to do with, look, you know, the uprising in Syria can be traced back partly to the fact that in a three-year drought, 800,000 farmers were driven off their land, and they're forced into the cities. There's very few jobs, and in a tightly controlled economy like that of Syria under Bashar al-Assad, you have a very clear reality that the only people who get jobs when there's very few available are those who know somebody in power. That means they're more likely to be Alawite, because that was the convening of the key forces at the center of power in Syria, and therefore it exacerbates tendencies that may have been very latent, may not have really been important at all, but suddenly the issue of sectarianism is a big factor in Syria, and it has everything to do with climate. So the notion of, I mean, I think this point that we just heard about the separation of the Middle East from the rest of the world in terms of the economy, et cetera, is very important. But it also means that we have to look more carefully to see how the actions of the rest of the world, the creation of a fossil fuel-based economy using oil from the region, et cetera, is affecting the region as well. It's a very, very important factor.
So coming back to after a break here, I want to come back and pick up on many of the things that you have all just pointed out and see where that takes us. But, you know, this has also affected the domestic policies of the United States, from the increased national security efforts, the $100 billion put new satellite programs in the air to watch everything that goes on under both Bush and Obama. That you've seen that take place, the amount of money we spend on international engagements, a war that has that's gone on for 15 years, that really hasn't ended, even though most of the troops are home, that it has altered the fabric of how we travel, the notion of what we mean by public safety, of our fear of public safety, our fear of living in this world. I mean, a lot has changed since 9/11 and in the way we responded to it. So, you know, I mean, that to me, Sam, is one of the biggest issues that we do not reflect on often enough, is how it has affected us internally here in America and in other nations around the world as well, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a huge factor. I mean, I think this is what I was referring to much earlier on when I said, you know, a lot of what we've done has either been counterproductive or, if not outright counterproductive, it's been useless. Before we get to civil liberties, which is not an inconsequential issue, which ought to be central for all of us, we have wasted ungodly sums of money, hundreds of billions of dollars on bureaucracy and initiatives and technology that makes a lot of money for some people, but at the end of the day doesn't contribute much of anything to making us more secure. And yes, God knows we have at various points seemed to go dangerously far down this road of saying, well, we'll just kind of sacrifice our individual liberty for the sake of security, which quite frankly terrifies me. I mean, that's at the heart of what wherever you are in the political spectrum ought to be at the heart of what the country is about, individual liberty. There can't possibly be an option where we just write that off for the sake of victory.
You know, I want to take a very quick break and come right back and have folks join us. Pick up the phone here, 410-319-8888. And I want to come back to all the things you three of you have just said and talk about what we've learned from these 15 years, in these last 15 years, and what we need to debate about where we're going. About how to change the course. Is it possible to even, some people would argue it's impossible to change the course. Can we change that course? We'll be right back with your thoughts on this 15th anniversary. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Please do join us at 410-319-8888. Where should our country and where should we, what we should be talking about in terms of where to take us now, 15 years after 9/11, given where the world is at this moment? We're here with Sam Faddis, who's a retired CIA operations officer and author of many books, including the novel Kaffa, Phyllis Bennis, director of New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of Iraq, a Primer, and many other books as well, and Dr. Tabit Abdullah, associate professor of Middle East history at York University in Toronto as well, and author of numerous books in the Middle East. And you all are 410-319-8888, and write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. But, you know, the big question, we could reflect a lot on where this has gone, and we have our battles and discussions over whether the war in Iraq made sense or not. I see most people thinking now, knowing the roots of it, that it did not. But the question is, where we are now. We watch Iraq, which is falling apart as a nation, as Sam was alluding to earlier. You see it in Afghanistan, the Syrian civil war, the Arab Spring that has led to more repression through most of the Arab world. Here in the United States, we now have spending hundreds of billions of dollars on just internally on our spy network, on the information awareness office most people don't even know about, or the satellite advanced Orion system that is throughout all these satellites that are just monitoring the entire world and monitoring kind of our overseas and maybe other emails and conversations that we're having as citizens, that this is kind of really exploded. And most people just, it's so quiet many ways, unless you're on top of the news, you don't pay attention to it, you're not even aware of it. So where do we, I mean, so what does that say about where we are now and where this, where we should be taking ourselves, what discussions should we be having, given I think that neither presidential candidate from a major party candidate seems to be addressing things in any different way than we have the last 15 years. So where does that take us, Phyllis Bennis?
Well, I think it takes us first to the need. This is where we have to start talking about movements. You're right that the major candidates are not talking about changing the policy in any significant way, despite rhetoric to the contrary. I think the first step is to acknowledge that 15 years of the global war on terror has failed. It's failed to bring democracy to any of the countries where it's been waged. It's failed to make people here or anywhere around the world safer. It has diverted billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in spending away from urgently needed issues of healthcare and education and infrastructure and jobs to go to a failing military strategy. So our first step has to be acknowledge that we were wrong. We have to do something different. Then I think it means if we believe, as President Obama, for instance, says over and over again, there is no military solution, stop acting as if the military part is the only part that's important, and pull out the troops, bring home the pilots and the drones, stop the bombing. It's not making things better, it's making things worse. Start with what every medical student learns on her first day in medical school. First, do no harm. The Hippocratic Oath, that could be the starting point. Number two, if we're looking at Syria, Syria is not just a civil war. Syria is now at least, by my last count, it's either 8 or 9 separate wars, regional wars, sectarian wars, global wars, all being fought to the last Syrian, as well as a civil war that's raging in that country. So we have to treat that with the understanding that this is a set of proxy wars that are underway alongside the Syrian war itself, and we need to move towards a real arms embargo. That's the only thing that's going to ultimately make a serious long-term ceasefire possible. Third, we have to stop investing everything in the war part of things, investment in terms of money, in terms of high-level attention. All those things need to go to new kinds of diplomacy. We saw in the successful effort around the Iran nuclear deal that it is possible to have diplomacy triumph over war. That was a huge victory, and we have to broaden that. So all of these things need to be on our agenda, but we have to do it. Mm-hmm. The only way it's going to work is if we have powerful movements that are demanding this kind of change, that are not content to go from crisis to crisis. How are we going to deal with this crisis? Okay, let's put a Band-Aid on that and wait for the next crisis where we get to the next Band-Aid. We have to look at these things systemically. I think the things we were hearing earlier about from Tabit about the economic stuff, these are crucial questions. And we can't any longer afford the luxury of saying, well, I sort of think that the war in Syria isn't really a good thing, but on the other hand, there's ISIS, so whatever they want to do about ISIS is okay, because ISIS is really bad. Yeah, ISIS is really bad, but the reason that it's so hard to challenge ISIS is because people where ISIS lives and fights don't necessarily all agree with us that ISIS is the biggest problem when they're being bombed by somebody else, whether it's Russian planes or whether it's American planes. So we have to look at these crises from the vantage point of people on the ground that are the targets of our policies. And my final point is just on how to look at one of the most recent massive crises that has been taken up in this country, although I would argue not nearly enough, and that is the refugee crisis. Not in this country. We don't have a refugee crisis. We have a racism crisis going on here. But there is a very real refugee crisis in the region surrounding Syria. And we have done way too little. All of the rhetoric about, well, we're paying more money than any other country, that may well be true, and it's profoundly irrelevant. When we control, we have in this country 28% of the wealth of the world, despite having only 5% of the population. Shouldn't we be paying, just as a starting point, at least 28% of what the UN needs to provide for the refugees and internally displaced? And shouldn't we be taking at least 28% of that small percentage of refugees who do need resettlement outside? I mean, the notion that we have bragged about taking 10,000 refugees, which is about half of what Germany was taking every day last year, is shameful. And as long as we separate the refugee question from the wars that are causing the refugees and the responsibility that we maintain for those wars, whether we started a lot of them, we've enabled a lot of the rest of them, we have an obligation. We have an obligation that comes from being the center of the empire, if you want to use that term, from being the strongest and wealthiest country in the history of the world. That brings obligations with us, and we have to think about our role in the world in exactly that way.
So, Sam, before I jump back to Tabit, I mean, when you ran for Congress, I know the one of the things that motivated you to want to run was the fact that you thought that what occurred under Bush and Obama over the last 15 years made huge mistakes, especially in the areas that Phyllis was talking about. So how would you respond to that same question?
Yeah, well, I mean, huge question, obviously. First, I would say I think we need to be more focused, and I would place the emphasis and the focus on, as harsh as it sounds, on what's our national interest. I'm not a big fan of nation building, and I don't really think we're in a position to solve all the world's problems. After that, I would say, for lack of a better way to characterize it, smarter. I mean, we are involved, and to grab a hold of a piece of the problem to illustrate that. We're in the process of supporting the Iraqi army, the Iraqi government, going into Anbar province, western Iraq, the Sunni heartland. They've taken Fallujah. Everybody's waiting for the assault on Mosul. This is an army that works for, as far as the Sunnis are concerned, a puppet state of the Iranians in Baghdad. A large proportion of the men that are doing the fighting as they go into Anbar are Shia militiamen who are basically armed, trained, and in many cases directed by the Iranians. So we are in the process, of, as far as the Sunnis are concerned, of supporting and flying air cover for a Shia invasion of Sunni heartland, and it's not particularly gentle. Hundreds of men disappeared after Fallujah fell and have never been seen again. We may very well overrun Anbar province, we writ large, we with these allies, only to find that this entire Sunni insurgency, which is the fuel from which ISIS has grown, just simply reignites under our feet all over again. Because fundamentally, we're not addressing any of the political issues. The political issues that George Bush ignored when he invaded and seemed to be surprised that the country went up in flames, the issues that were ignored when we walked away in 2011, we're ignoring them all over again. So we have no reason to think that we're going to come out of the other end of this and not find that the whole place goes up in flames again. I mean, we've got to get more sophisticated and smarter and savvier than that if we're really going to address some of these issues.
So, Talbot, pick up, I mean, in some sense, because there are similarities and vast contradictions here between what Phyllis just said and Sam just said in terms of where we're going. And one of the things that Sam said about Iran's power inside of Iraq, it's amazing, I think, almost to a person. Every Iraqi I speak to in this country says the same thing about it being a puppet state of Iran, and this is a proxy war there. And we don't talk about that very much, that whether we agree or disagree with that being the reality. Can you pick up on that point?
Well, certainly the whole drama that beset Iraq resulted in increasing Iranian influence and hegemony, whether it's a complete puppet state or not. You know, we may disagree on that, but there's no doubt that Iran is far more influential than it ever dreamt of being before the American invasion. But getting back on this to this issue of, you know, what should America do? You know, first of all, I think it's very important for Americans to stop asking that question too much. You know, I'm sorry, I don't mean that, you know, to you personally, Mark, but America's ability. I mean, if there's one thing that really has come out from the whole debacle of the United States directly being involved after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait and so forth, is the limitations of American power. Oftentimes it does make the situation much, much worse, both in terms of the extent of destruction and the hatred that's directed toward the United States and to the West. So I think, to begin with, perhaps Americans and American candidates shouldn't be going around making these blanket statements about how I would solve the problem of the Middle East or the Ukraine or Taiwan or something else. America has very clear limits on its power. It can't really just, you know, wave a magic wand and solve this. In terms of the Middle East, I would agree that there should be less of an emphasis on military solutions, more of an emphasis on perhaps economic assistance to refugees, humanitarian assistance, and so forth. But I wouldn't completely counsel that the United States should wash its hands of certain military obligations, very specific targeted goals. I think the United States should continue with this, but really, I mean, you're asking in many ways an impossible question. And, you know, just reading the Arab press just over, you know, the weekend in preparation for this interview today, almost uniformly, from Egypt to the Lebanese press to the Syrian, you know, both the opposition and the government press, the Iraqi press, there is an overwhelming sense that the West can't do very much. It's already messed things up. There is no magic solution anymore. I agree very much with Sam that there should be that certain clearly limited goals should be picked with much more intelligence. But any kind of broad general promises of how the whole situation is going to be solved is counterproductive. The other thing I would suggest is that Americans hopefully will not vote for a warmongering racist who's done nothing but stir up more hatred in his own country and abroad also. I mean, I don't think that would help.
I'm not going to argue on that point, but I think that, you know, Phyllis, this is, over the years, I've been reflecting a lot on the conversations we've had in this program over the last 15 years or so, since 9/11, and I remember very early on in conversation that we had when you were on the air with Tobit, when Tobit was just beginning to think about moving to Canada from Syria, that you all were on pretty much the same page when it came to your opposition to this looming, impending war in Iraq. And I remember, Sam, you also had great reservations as well in the book you wrote about your experiences there in the CIA before the war started. And so, but now the interesting juxtaposition here is, well, it sounds like Tobit was saying that he didn't disagree with a lot of what you were saying. The military aspect of it, I think he's saying, and many people are saying, is difficult to completely walk away from. And I think that's the conundrum on, I think, many people who were against the war, people who are progressive on the left, are having, is what does that mean?
Right.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. I don't think it's easy to walk away from a military commitment that has shaped and defined our so-called global war on terror for 15 years. But I think we have to look at it from the vantage point of it has failed. It has failed in every single thing it was supposed to do. Everything it was supposed to do in Iraq, now in Syria, in Afghanistan, it has failed. The one thing in Afghanistan that people kept saying was, well, at least now the kids have can go to school, particularly the girls. Well, it turns out not so much. We heard just a few months ago from one of the reports of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan, that despite all of the propaganda about the great success of the U.S. education program and the $150 billion that was spent on it, that 44% of the kids in Afghanistan under the age of 10 have never been to school, and that the rest have usually had to drop out before the fifth grade. So this notion that we are somehow making things better is simply not true, and we have to acknowledge it. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's easy for a country whose current economy, as ours is so dependent on the profits made by so many parts of military producers, the military contractors, military manufacturing. All of those things are enormously influential parts of our economy. It's not surprising that the F-35 fighter bomber that the Pentagon doesn't even want and says they can't use gets voted on by Congress over and over again for hundreds of billions of dollars to be officially, openly, and acknowledged wasted, because in every single congressional district, there's a few jobs in some factory somewhere that have something to do with manufacturing that plane, and so no one in Congress is prepared to vote against it. That makes this very, very hard. I have no illusions that it's going to be something that any president could just do, but it has to be what we work towards, because this isn't working. We need diplomacy, not war.
I'm sorry, I do want to go to Sam. What were you just saying, real quick, Tobit, before I go back to Sam?
I'm just saying it's the difficulty of it is not just because it's difficult to actually implement as policy. It's also difficult, Phyllis, because there were times where military intervention did save lives. And though I agree with you
that
in the long run,
not the U.S.
That in the long run, this limited policy of simply depending on military intervention is, of course, harmful. But there were the campaign against ISIS did indeed limit their expansion, and it saved the lives of many thousands of people.
I would argue that those lives were saved by the local military forces, particularly the Kurdish forces in Syria. But
those local forces, I mean, if you really, pay attention to what they say, they are the ones calling for more U.S.
I understand why a lot of
support.
People are calling for it, because they're desperate.
Yes,
they
exactly. They're desperate for a good reason.
Because there haven't been other options out there.
Yes, I agree.
I don't blame people for calling for it. That doesn't make it right. It doesn't mean that we should support it. I understand why people call for it. They did. There were people in Iraq as well who welcomed the U.S. Not a lot, but there were some, and they were not all just the opportunists who wanted to ride back into Baghdad on the back of U.S. tanks. They weren't all Ahmad Chalabi. There were honest people who thought this was going to work. They were wrong. And I'm afraid that the people in Syria who are calling for it are wrong also. I understand why they would, why they'd be desperate enough to call for it, but that doesn't make it acceptable. We can't pretend that the U.S. is doing this for humanitarian reasons.
No. Nobody's saying that.
People on the ground are. People on the ground, some are saying, we need them to protect us. We want U.S. weapons without strings attached. But that's never happened anywhere.
So, Haba, finish your thought, then I'm going to go back to Sam.
No, I mean, nobody at all, Phyllis, really thinks that any kind of American military involvement is because they like the black eyes of Iraqi children. You know, it is for very selfish reasons. But there are cases where this kind of the drive to intervene militarily can be utilized for some progressive gain. It's not a zero-sum option, either military intervention or no military intervention. There are cases where very specific military intervention could actually be helpful, and I believe it has been with some cases. But if this was the only policy over a long the only strategy for the whole region is to deal with the problems of instability through only military action, then of course I agree with you.
So,
anyway, this is a conversation we've been having for a long time, and I'm not sure we're going to agree on it anytime soon.
So, Sam, again, coming in, I think that what Phyllis Bennett has pointed out earlier in this conversation about the things we need to think about that are alternative policies than just this military policy. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. I mean, did you hear how that plays into what you think is in the strategic best interests of the United States?
Look, in general, what I think is that we ought to be a lot more prudent, a lot more selective, wiser about our use of power. I agree 100%. Fantasies of an American ability to simply transform problems, deal with issues that nobody's been able to solve for 1,500 years, forget about it. The neocon idea that we can simply go forth and reshape the earth, I reject completely. I would add this to the debate. Unfortunately, we don't have a rewind button on history. So we can't just walk in as a president and say, I'm going to act in a vacuum as if the decisions that were made before me were never made. The Bush administration made uncounted errors in Iraq. Maybe the first one was going in at all. That doesn't change the fact that when it's 2011 and you're Barack Obama, you are stuck with that legacy as much as you may despise it. Making a decision to then act like you can simply walk away from Iraq and there will not be consequences is ill-advised. You know, Colin Powell said it best. You broke it, you bought it. We are in. We made those decisions. So I don't think we can simply pick up and go home. Be more careful, more selective, more prudent, all of those things, every other adjective we can think of, absolutely. We don't have the option of just walking away.
So, I mean, as we wind this conversation down, I mean, I think the complexity of it is what I think the three of you have brought to this conversation from very political perspectives. And, you know, Phyllis, obviously, that you look at, and we didn't really touch too deeply what you need to do another day, which is on the intelligence apparatus internally in America and how that has changed in 15 years and how we are kind of really ignoring that, I think, is part of a national conversation about where we're going, which Sam alluded to earlier. But we're also in a world where the United States is behind Saudi Arabia, supports Saudi Arabian government, supports the Egyptian government. And how difficult it is to turn that ship around the way we're describing it, Phyllis, to even begin to think about how you change that, given the world, the people argue the vacuum being left to Russia and whoever else if the United States is not in the middle. It's a complex thing from both an establishment and old line perspective in terms of how you view this world to how we need to begin to think in different ways.
It's a huge challenge, and none of it is easy. I think, ironically, the diplomatic challenge that you're referring to right now in terms of our longstanding support for these horrifying, warmongering, repressive governments in places like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, now Egypt, it starts with the military side. So, you know, this notion that, well, if we don't sell arms to the Saudis, they'll just buy them from China, or they'll buy them from Russia. It doesn't work that way. They have a whole system that's based on U.S. military systems. You can't just turn that around instantly. If the U.S. said that of our $115 billion worth of contracts that have been offered to the Saudis alone in the years since Obama has been president, that the ones that haven't been sent yet, they're not going to be sent as long as you are continuing your brutal war in Yemen. That would have an enormous impact in Saudi Arabia. They wouldn't be able to simply call up Moscow and say, please send us X number of Russian planes to replace the Boeing planes we're not going to get and Russian tanks to replace the M1 tanks we're not going to get. It doesn't work that way. It would have a huge impact. So that military step taken first to say we are no longer going to be the provider, the enabler of these military assaults and these assaults on the people of these countries by supplying police forces, we're just not going to do it anymore, that would have a huge impact in the region as a first step. It doesn't change by itself our whole history of relations with these countries, our responsibility for what they have become, what they've done. But it does take a first step to say we are no longer going to be the military enablers of it. That's huge. That would be huge. And we could do that.
So we have about 2 minutes left here. Let's get just quick closing thoughts. Sam and then Tabit.
Well, I think I've said it. We need to be smarter. We need to be a lot more focused. We need to be a lot more cautious about where we're involved. Unfortunately, the reality is we face a real and a continuing threat that we're going to be facing for a long time from what amounts to certain elements of Islamic extremism and terrorism. That is real. It is not over. We are not safe.
Tabit Abdallah?
I agree with both people mentioned at the end there. I think the storms that have engulfed the Middle East, I think there's another wave that's coming. It's very important for an incredible power like the United States to be prepared for that and not to respond in the ways that they have in the past. And one, you know, good way is to try and create a sense of justice in its own country, rather than stir up hatred and racism. I think that Saudi Arabia could be a place that we should really look at. The government is proposing all kinds of new reforms, which they've proposed many times before without fulfilling, but the decline in oil prices and so forth is really going to affect those societies, and more so Saudi Arabia than any others. So, and I think the Middle East is on the verge of another wave of uprisings.
We will keep on that and have all of you back to continue looking at that. Dr. Tabit Abdallah, thank you so much for joining us once again. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Associate Professor of Middle East History at York University, Toronto, Phyllis Bennis, Director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Always good to have you with us, Phyllis. Thank you so much. And Sam Faddis, thank you, retired CIA operations officer and author and political activist. Sam, thank you so much for being with us as well. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to go local and see what's happening in our city between Port Covington and crime in our town, talking to people running for office, see what they think.